Going Linux, episode 213, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Bill. Whether you're new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you'll find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
In today's episode, listener feedback.
Okay, Bill, hopefully our internet connection will hang in there while we record this episode, and we've got lots of listener feedback this time around.
Yes, we do. But before we get into that, guess what, Larry?
What?
The fastest supercomputer runs Linux.
Really? What's the fastest supercomputer?
The new one from in China. It apparently is running a specialized version of Linux, and apparently they haven't even opened the thing up yet. So it's got lots of room to grow. So I wonder if they would let me play with it.
Maybe, but you'd have to learn. What's the version of Linux that they use over there? Red Flag Linux or something?
I don't think it's Red Flag. I think it's. I know it's based on Fedora, from what I remember reading. But I believe that it's got some new bits and bobs. But it is Linux, and apparently this thing has. Like 15,000 cores or something. It's some insane amount. So I'm sure it could play Team Fortress 2 really well.
yeah, exactly. Well, I'm sure the NSA is already in it, so don't worry about it. We're moving along.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, well, with that, shall we get into our voicemails? We have a few of them this time.
We do. I see that.
Okay, our first voicemail is actually a voice message that was sent by way of Voxer from Herjan, and he provides us the correct pronunciation of the Dutch greeting provided by listener Andy in our last listener feedback episode. It's a long way around, a very short message, but here goes.
G'day, Mr. Bushy. Gerrion de Vries speaking here. I wrote in a few times with some reviews and stuff on your podcast, and I was just listening to your listener feedback where the English guy gave you a Dutch greeting, and the correct pronunciation of that is groetjes. I'll repeat, groetjes, and it just means greetings. Love the podcast. Keep it up. See you again.
Okay. Well, yeah, thanks, Herjan. I'm glad you repeated it. I'm not sure I can, but then again, I don't know Dutch. Yeah, so, okay, again, thank you, and thanks for reaching out on Voxer. Voxer is a service that's provided for mobile phones. It kind of works like a walkie-talkie sort of thing. And Nightwise and I have been exchanging a few messages occasionally using Voxer. And Herjan is on there as well. And he reached out to me through Voxer. So new service that we're not actually going to publicize that as an official way of getting a hold of the Going Linux podcast. But it's a useful tool, and maybe we'll be able to use it a little more in the future. We'll see. And speaking of Nightwise.
Nightwise himself sent us an audio file by email. He recommends a command and access tool for desktop sliding Linux users. So let's give that a listen.
Hey Larry. Hey Bill. Nightwise calling from Nightwise.com. Wanted to give you a little tip on for all of those cross, not platform, but cross desktop sliding Linux users that your podcast has. What I've been noticing is that it is sometimes easy for your brain to hop across different Linux distributions with different user interfaces, but it's not easy for your body to do so. I'll explain. Whether I use Unity, XFCE, LXDE, or I'm on my Mac or on a Windows system, it's always a little bit of a chore to remember which buttons to press to launch my application. I've found it frustrating that I've been moving my mouse around all around the screen trying to find, oh yeah, it's Unity, so the button with the applications is here, and this is LXDE, and it's there, and this is XFCE, so it's there, and oh, now I'm using KDE, and it's here, and it's GNOME, and it's there. Very frustrating. So what I was looking for was a unified way to launch my applications on the different desktop user interfaces that I use. The solution comes in the form of Kupfer. Kupfer, spelled K-U-P-F-E-R, it's German for copper, is a launcher. You can tie it to a certain keyboard combination. It's a little bit like GNOME Do, but better. It allows you to launch applications, search queries, look into your files, do all kinds of things. And it is available on most, if not all, Debian-based operating systems. I've enjoyed using Kupfer on Linux Mint with Cinnamon, Ubuntu, Zubuntu, Lubuntu, Kubuntu? Yeah. Probably had them all. And I've also been looking for applications that kind of do the same on both Windows and Mac. Now, the trick with the body trying to remember is that you have muscle memory. Muscle memory is the way your body instinctively remembers how to do things. So when I'm in Ubuntu or Zubuntu or whatever Ubuntu or Mint, I just hit the Windows key or the super key and enter, and Kupfer boots pops up, and I can just punch in the name of the application that I want to use. The great thing is, no matter on what OS that I am, it's always there, it's always below the same keyboard combination, and it's always the same way of interacting with my system. So I can get the best out of every desktop UI that I want. Yet launching my applications and the way I launch my applications is something that is the same across the board. Kupfer is available on most Debian-based installations. It's better than GNOME Do, and I really like using it. It's very powerful. I've only scratched the surface, but just as an application launcher, it's so great that if you're distro hopping, that you will always have the same way of launching your applications. If you're ever interested, look me up, www.nightwise.com, the website with hacks, tips, and tweaks for cross-platform geeks.
Well, Nightwise, thanks for the tip on Kupfer. We'll include a link in the show notes. And I don't know of anything on Mac or Windows that would do the same thing quite that he describes Kupfer as doing. I know that I've used Auto key on Linux and auto hotkey on Windows, which are kind of similar to Text Expander on the Mac, to record keystrokes or to actually set up keystrokes that are common between, in my case, Linux and Windows, so that I can use exactly the same key combination to perform the same action, although it may be a different software program that it's launching or a different way of accomplishing the same thing, but at least have the same key command or shortcut to do it. I'm not aware of anything for Windows and Mac. Have you come across anything in your travels, Bill?
Actually, this is not a software type that I actually use, so I want to say no. I'm constantly blowing away things and trying new stuff, so if I ever decide to, you know, actually stay with a distribution long enough to actually learn it, yeah, I might find something, but you know me, I'm always saying, oh, look at the pretty shiny toys on the other side. Yeah. And I'm jumping over looking at them. So, no, long answer for a short question. No, I'm not really sure of anything.
Okay, well, Nightwise will keep on the lookout. I'm going to try Kupfer and find out
what it does.
Yeah, it does. Sounds very useful. I didn't know it existed. All right. Our next email, we've actually got two emails from a gentleman known as No 9-to-5 Blogger. And I'm sure there's a blog somewhere in that. And we'll play his two messages back to back. In fact, by the time our audience hears this, they'll be edited together. But Bill, you and I are going to listen to the two raw recordings. So
all right.
Here goes.
Hi, I'm Bill and Larry. This is No9to5 Blogger. And I listened to your podcast for a while. And I had thought about, you know, using Xmint and hung on had left the CD laying around and ended up going to a fork of Ubuntu called Ultimate Edition, and I had a lot of problems with it. But anyways, I do enjoy your show. Continue to listen to your podcast, and I had a couple of questions for you. And this is concerning the PPA and Ola distros, and I was just wondering, can you take Ola distros and use the PPA to regain the repository to make them useful again, basically, because I've got, you know, a 904, a special edition of 904 that has some, you know, Google desktops and Picasa program in there that I really like, and I didn't want to throw it away. So, Larry Arbil, let me know what can, you know, I do about that, and now check the show notes for it. All right? Everybody have a great day. All right? Bye.
Is he trying to reuse the PPA? Is that what he's trying to do?
No. Here's what he's trying to do. He has sent some emails that I've responded to. He's had some trouble getting some things set up. So in addition to the voicemails, he's exchanged some emails with us. And his first issue with Ultimate Edition, I think he's installing this on maybe a computer that has UEFI enabled. And Ultimate Edition is based on Ubuntu before they put the fix for UEFI in it. So that may have been his problem. Secondly, he's got an old Ubuntu 9.04 CD that he doesn't want to throw away. You know, it's a, I don't know how he ended up with a 9.04 CD, but he's trying to install that, and because it's no longer supported, I suspect that some of the repositories and maybe even some of the PPAs no longer maintained, and he's having some trouble with it. So I've recommended that, because this is an old version, that he does go ahead and throw that one away. If he wants to, you know, use it to try out Ubuntu, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But please try to remember that because it's not supported, you're not going to find, you know, any support for it. And as a result, some things are going to get out of date very quickly. And some things won't work simply because people aren't paying any attention to it anymore. So my recommendation was to get on the latest long-term support release. And if he doesn't like the Unity version, to perhaps try Mint, or perhaps the long-term support release that was just before Unity came out, and I think that was 10.04.
Mm-hmm.
I think if he doesn't like Unity, I mean, that may be his reason for sticking with 9.04, but he could use either one. And if he really doesn't want to use Unity, he's going to have to either install a different desktop or go with a different distribution altogether. So hopefully he takes that to heart and installs something more recent and begins to use that if if this is more than just trying out Linux, if he actually wants to install it, I'd suggest going with a more recent and supported distribution of Linux.
It's really not a good idea to use Linux that's no longer supported. There's so many good options out there. If you don't like the Unity interface, like you said, you have, just to give them some ideas, you have Pingai, which is a kind of a super customized version of Ubuntu. You've got Mint, which, you know, they have their own desktop. They have a couple different flavors. Larry, just out of curiosity, since I don't follow Mint as close as you do, how many different desktops do they have?
Well, they have the Cinnamon, the Mate, and the XFCE that they officially support. There's a KDE version that is not, it's no longer part of the Mint proper, but it is still supported. They've got a company, Blue something or other. Blue Systems that's maintaining that. And they've got a couple of derivatives. Solid XK is what it goes by. So there's an XFCE and a KDE version that goes along with that, that started as an offshoot of Mint, started by one of the previous contributors to Mint itself. So those are your options with Mint.
Yeah. And just kind of, if he is not liking Unity, I would say then the closest thing to the old GNOME 2 would be the XFCE version. So you might want to give that a look.
Or Mate. Mate is a lot more like GNOME 2, which is what the older Ubuntu's were based on. And, you know, the Mate that comes with Mint has a single panel at the bottom, but it's very easy to put an additional panel at the top. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have posted an article on the Going Linux website that is a companion to our episodes on customizing your Linux desktop, where I describe how to get into the options that allow you to set those panel settings on Mate.
Yeah. I had XFCE on my brain because I've been playing with Slackware with XFCE. Uh-huh. And I just thought to myself that looked a lot like the old GNOME 2. But
it does. Yeah. It does. It's a little different behavior. And Mate mm-hmm. has faithfully replicated the way...
They just renamed some of the components, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And, you know, they've rebuilt a lot of it from the ground mm-hmm. up. But, you know, it works just like GNOME 2 did. So if you liked GNOME 2, then Mate is for you.
All right. Larry, you read our first email on The Last Computer America, and this was so cool, I thought that it would be cool to read it again. And this is for the listeners that pass over the Computer American episodes. And it's from Robert, and he writes, Larry and Bill.
Hey, Robert.
Hey, Robert. I had to share this story. My wife and I are at the bank opening our business accounts. While the banker is doing his thing on their computer system, my wife comments to both the banker and I that she is the CFO. My response is that I am the CEO, CTO, and COO, and more. At which time she says, no, just my minion. And my response was, no, chief executive minion, CEM. And the banker stops what he's doing, looks over at me and says, going Linux? And I start laughing, and my wife was looking at us, realizes what we are saying, and says, no, geeks are everywhere. We all laughed. You are doing a much better job at getting the word out than you think. Congratulations. Yeah. Thanks, Robert.
Yeah, really like that. That email. That was good.
By the way, CEM is, I trademarked that, so every time you say CEM, you have to pay Larry a dollar.
Of which Bill gets a nickel. So, moving along. Just kidding. Our next email is from Case in the Netherlands, who asks about Linux in a big company. And he did this on our forum. So this is actually not an email, but a forum post.
Cool.
He says, "Hello, Larry and Bill. This started as a mail, but I found this is the spot to enter podcast suggestions. Some of what I write here has been in your podcast, but I would like businesses to hear a semi-complete recipe for going Linux. I'm a longtime listener to your podcast, missing Tom, but you guys still produce one of my favorite podcasts. Around 1997, I first started using Linux for a server, but only in the last 5 years, I've used it full-time for my laptop. I love Linux Mint, although I still miss GNOME 2. Also, I have been using Linux on my business desktop for over a year, but I can't anymore because of a different function. I have a suggestion for a show concerning that item. I work at a Windows-centered business, quite a few Red Hat Enterprise Linux servers exist, but no Linux for office and desktop use. When I ask managers why they don't try LibreOffice, the answer is simple. There is no business case. Why? Because they have a contract in which they pay for the number of potential users, and Microsoft Office comes almost free apart from Outlook, which is paid. At least, that's what they tell me. And Outlook plus Exchange are critical to our business. And I have to agree, that's probably the biggest obstacle to getting open source software into an enterprise that uses Microsoft is the way Microsoft licenses their products. If a computer is capable of running Microsoft Office, you have to pay them for the license.
Really?
Whether you put it on there or not. Continuing. And when I ask why they don't use Samba servers, a similar thing goes. A contract is made with great discount in which a price is paid per user for the whole company. So they don't have to pay less for using less. Huh. Another way to look at that, I guess, is you're paying more whether you're using it or not. But I guess that doesn't support their argument. Anyway, in a Microsoft environment, you have to pay CALs, client access licenses, for every client connected to Windows servers. This is bought off in the contract, but clients using something other than Windows have to pay an extra CAL, where Windows clients don't need this. Oh, I see.
Huh?
Yeah. So in other words, you pay a license for everyone connected to the Windows server, whether they're using file sharing and print sharing or not. Mm-hmm. And if you have another computer that's connected to the network and somehow or other touches the Windows server, you have to pay extra for that.
You're kidding me.
That's what it says here.
Wow.
Yeah. And, of course, everything is glued together using Active Directory. Conclusion, going Linux with desktops and office automation costs time, which equates to money, and human resources, but there is no direct financial gain. Question, is there a good alternative for Outlook and Exchange, including a good agenda function, groups, etc.? How can we solve incompatibility between Microsoft Office and LibreOffice, and more specific, Word and Writer? Can a business case be made to migrate from Windows servers to Samba? Is a good alternative available for Active Directory? In short, how can we make a big organization go Linux? Some suggestions, Raspberry Pi or similar as a replacement of Windows-based terminal, stick it to the back of a full HD monitor and go. Doesn't work very well with multimedia, but WBTs don't either. What's a WBT?
Oh,
Windows-based terminals?
Basic terminal.
I don't know. Just replace the SD card to have a new version. Link to possible documentation of a Linux environment, Munich, Germany. Possibility to use Citrix or similar to make Windows available from Linux clients. Put the whole Microsoft environment in a different network in which to prevent having to use client access licenses. What does your contract with Microsoft say exactly on this point? Use some rsync stuff to synchronize the Windows environment to the Linux environment. Start using Firefox, LibreOffice, and other cross-platform apps and formats in order to make migrating as painless as possible. I hope this mail gives you a useful item, and I hope you can find a good alternative to Outlook and Exchange for a big company. And he writes in Dutch, with kind regards from Harderwijk, the Netherlands. Case. and hopefully I pronounced the city name correctly. And the only reason I knew what he wrote says with kind regards is because he provided the translation. Thanks, Case. So lots of questions there. And we really need some help with this one. In order to provide a full episode on this. So here's a call out to Going Linux listeners who may already have faced the challenges of trying to get, or perhaps even successfully getting, a Windows shop to begin using Linux computers on the desktop, or even just open source software of any kind on the desktop, and found a way around these licenses. Initially, my suggestion, I think, is try to get everything on the cloud. By getting things on the cloud, then you're using the browser, and because your computer, the computer you're using is going to the internet rather than using the Windows server, I think that avoids that add-on licensing thing that Windows is sticking you with when you put a Linux machine on the network and then use anything touching the Windows server. And certainly if you're going to stick with Outlook, there's a web-based version of Outlook that gives you that. If you want a cloud-based version of an Office suite, of course, Microsoft provides that at an exorbitant per month license fee, possibly in addition to whatever you're paying for the desktop licenses. I don't know that for a fact. Or you can use something like Google Office, the Office tools from Google that are part of Google, what used to be Google Docs and Spreadsheets. So they have their documents, spreadsheets, and presentations online. There are plenty of other cloud-based Office suites as well. And I understand LibreOffice is looking to put their Office suite on the cloud as well. Or maybe that's OpenOffice. I've forgotten which is which on that one. Any suggestions from you, Bill?
Actually, just a few. I know the pain of working for a big corporation that uses a lot of Windows programs, and it's not that they're using Windows and Windows-based programs. It's that whether you know it or not, not all the versions of Windows Office talk to each other. Sometimes they have, especially if they have formatting, like 2007 doesn't talk well with an older version. And apparently, they call it volume licensing. Does that sound right?
Yep, volume licenses, yep.
Yeah, they get the volume licenses, so, you know, they have some older machines that are running 2003 Office and 2007 Office and 2010, and we've actually had, my boss will send us it seems to do it on Excel the most. They'll send something with a lot of customized things in Excel, and it won't open properly on an older version of Excel. But I've had good luck by being able to have Google has been able to reformat it so I can read it. And also it's been able to open up LibreOffice, Word, the Office format. And what's the Microsoft's proprietary version?
Word processor?
Yeah.
Word?
The extension.
Oh, the DocX.
Yeah, DocX. But I've had some problem, and I wanted to ask you about this while we're talking about this, because, you know, if you're going to try to go to a all Linux or, you know, online, Office suite, you need to be able to talk to these different file formats. Did you know that a lot of those docx's sometimes, if it comes from an older version, won't play well with the new one?
Oh yeah, definitely. And there are some components of Microsoft Office's suite that aren't provided with the standard or the professional version, or whatever they're calling it these days. Mm-hmm. Some components that you have to purchase extra, where if you upgrade to the latest version, it will not open the any previous version ever. One that comes to mind is Microsoft MapPoint, which provides you a way if you have salespeople and you need to map out their sales territories. MapPoint is a very nice program for taking, let's say, postal codes, mm-hmm. and or any other kind of definition of what makes up their territory, and be able to map it on a nice map of whatever your country is, and provide a colored outline of the sales territories. Well, the current version of Microsoft MapPoint is about $400, and if you use the previous version of MapPoint last year, the current version will not open the files from last year's. No, really? Not at all. Not at all. And so because you're using postal codes change mm-hmm. from year to year. You really can't use a 2-year-old version of MapPoint because, you know, it's got 3-year-old postal code data in it because, you know, they start building it and release it a year before its actual date. So 2010 has 2009 wow. postal codes in it, for example. So you can't really use an old one because your territories won't be right if you use it. And so you have to upgrade to get the latest postal codes. And there's no plugin or add-on for postal codes. So you have to upgrade. And unless you've got a volume license, which typically you wouldn't purchase unless you're getting everyone a copy of MapPoint, and typically mm-hmm. it's just the head office that needs to do the maps, and that's maybe one or two people that need to work with it. So you're paying $400 at a crack every year times the number of people who are using it just to do maps.
That is crazy.
Well, it's profitable.
Yeah. Anyway, I've been using the Google Online Service, the Office, to open these formats and save it as, I believe it, the extension's ODT, the Open Document Format.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that's worked well. So that's just a possibility. But that's craziness that you can't open last year's data from last year's program.
Yeah, and it's not just a file extension thing. It's a they actually purposely make the file format incompatible somehow. So it just flat out won't open.
How did they get away with that?
They've got the market locked up.
Oh, that helps.
The monopoly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. I was just wondering if I couldn't open some data that I had put all in there. You pretty much, it's like you're held hostage. You want your data, you got to pay us.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Exactly wow. right.
Okay, moving right along. Mm-hmm. Our next email is from Renee, which you've exchanged a few emails, and you also read one of his emails on The Last Computer America. And here's the latest question he asked. He says, thank you for the mail. Which version of Linux Mint can I use? Is it the Linux Mint 15 Olivia, Linux Mint Debian, or Linux Mint 13 LTS? I would like to install a version that is LTS. If I install the newest, I do not want to have to install another version again in 6 months. I like the support to January 2014, unless, of course, this is just to upgrade, but do not know if I can. With Linux Mint 13 LTS version, I get support until April 2017. Now I have been told that the LTS version of Linux Mint software would cause me to lag behind. If I'm using Linux Mint Debian, is it still easy to use Linux Mint, or is this something for an advanced user? I hope that you understand this email. I had to translate it with Google. 73, Renee. Then before we could respond back, Renee sent a follow-up email. He wrote, I have Linux Mint 15 installed. It's a nice OS. Had some problems with the installation. I had just created an ext4 partition in a Dutch form. I had to ask for some help, and they told me to create a root partition, swap partition, and possibly a home partition. Linux Mint 15 is running now, and I am very happy with it. 73, Renee.
Yeah, and we're very glad that you got things up and running, even without our help, but thanks to the folks in the Dutch forum that helped you out.
Yeah.
To answer some of your questions about long-term support and the releases in between, so Mint 15, Olivia, is an interim release. Mint 13 is the long-term support release. And it is supported until 2017, as opposed to the 2014 support on the interim release from Linux Mint. And really, if you're looking not to have to reinstall every 6 months, I would definitely recommend sticking with the long-term support releases. Now, since you've installed Linux Mint 15, that's okay. I think that what you can do is when the next long-term support release comes out, switch to that. And then just stick with the long-term support releases from then on. And then you'll only be reinstalling every 2 years or so. So Linux Mint 15, the current version, should be supported at least through the next long-term support release. And that should help you out, I think, right?
Yeah, it sounds that'd be the best way. Now, the Linux Mint 15 is not an LTS. It's just a interim.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes, that's right. 13 was the long-term.
Okay. So do they allow, maybe I misunderstood, someone told me that certain Linux Mint that you couldn't upgrade from a intermittent or intermediate to a LTS. I thought it had to be a clean install. Is that wrong?
Well, no, it's not quite that. What it is that although Ubuntu puts a lot of effort into making the Ubuntu versions upgradable using the package manager, essentially, and you can do the same sorts of things with Linux Mint. It's not as reliable, or at least in the past, it hasn't been as reliable to upgrade from version to version, any version, whether it's the 6 months version or whether it's a long-term support version. So I always recommend a fresh install when it comes to Linux Mint, although I've seen some evidence that they're working on making it work better. I just feel that it's safer. Even with Ubuntu, when I was using it, I would do a fresh install. And the reason for that is mainly because they change applications, they change desktop environment, they make some changes that when you upgrade, they have to make an assumption. They have to either assume that what you installed is what you want, which means you're getting the old stuff ported over to your upgraded installation, or they have to assume that you want the new stuff that they've put in to the upgraded version, which means they uninstall your old version and replace it with the new version. And that may be an entirely new application, like for email or something like that. So, and I've had that happen to me on Ubuntu. And what happens there is you don't lose your email messages or your setup or your history, but you do have to, if you don't want to use the new version, you have to go and install your old email client again and uninstall the one they provided. So it's never a clean thing unless you're using stock Ubuntu or stock Linux Mint out of the box and you haven't added anything yourself. You haven't installed any of your own applications. You're just using it the way it comes. Then the upgrade will go perfectly. And they will make the appropriate assumptions and everything will just work. But if you've installed anything on your own or replaced any default application with another application that you prefer, there's a risk there that your upgrade may not go as planned.
Well, I know Tom had upgraded from, I think he said Hardy Heron up until the last one. He had just kept upgrading, and it worked. But I remember just before, you know, he decided to step away, that he was finally starting to have some problems with his install. But he had been upgrading from one version to another for like version after version after version, and it worked. It was just then starting to get a little crazy.
Yep.
But anyway.
Okay, well, hopefully things continue to work well for you, Renee, and thanks very much.
Yeah, good luck with that Linux Mint.
Okay, Dave wrote in with a problem that eventually most Linux users will experience. We'll provide links to some of the solutions in the show notes, of course. Dave writes, "Hi, great informative podcast, guys. Thank you." Well, hi, Dave.
Hi, Dave.
I recently began distro hopping to the different Linux flavors to decide which one I wanted to upgrade to. Initially, I was using live USBs, but got the bright, in quotes, idea to install Kubuntu to an extra removable hard drive I had laying around. Big mistake, kinda. Now, in order to boot my W machine, that drive has to be plugged in. Due to grub? How do I uninstall or return to my old boot method so I don't need the external drive plugged in? I plan on backing up my files and then doing a clean install of Linux and Windows 7 dual boot in the future with grub. Requiring the external drive to be plugged in, I fear I have complicated things. Any advice or links would be helpful and would be appreciated. New avid listener, Dave. And I've exchanged some emails with Dave and have sent him a couple of links. These links we'll have in the show notes. One is a Microsoft article on restoring the MBR, the master boot record. And Dave, your instinct is correct. Grub has installed itself as the bootloader because you had the Windows drive in place at the same time you were installing Linux to the external drive. Grub just said, oh, you want to convert this to a dual boot system, and we'll use Grub to manage that, and has wiped out the master boot record on your Windows disk. So there's a Microsoft technical article on how to restore your master boot record. It assumes that you have the installation media, which, of course, you won't have if you bought your computer with Windows pre-installed, and unless you're willing to contact your computer manufacturer, pay them a fee to send you the disk, or you want to go out and spend $400 or so dollars on a fresh copy of Windows, that's probably something you don't want to do in any case. So we've also included a link on how to restore your master boot record for Windows 7 if you don't have the installation disks handy. So hopefully both of those will help you out. And in fact, Dave has subsequently emailed back to us and said he's got everything up and running. I don't know whether that's with the help of the links we've provided or whether that was due to your reinstallation, but Dave, we're just very happy that you got things back working the way they should. So, word of advice to folks who are installing Linux on a machine that has any operating system already on it. When you install Linux to even a second hard drive or a USB drive that you've got plugged in, if you install it, that new bootloader, whatever comes with the latest version that you're installing, will be the primary bootloader for your system. A way to get around that is to disconnect or remove the drive, the main drive that you have, then install Linux. It will install the bootloader on just that secondary drive. It won't even see the other drive because it is, in fact, disconnected. And then when you reconnect the drive and you use your BIOS to tell your computer which drive to boot from, Essentially, you can manage your dual boot in that way. Not the preferred way for dual booting, but it is the preferred way if you want to remove that external drive at any point and still have your system bootable. And I've had that happen with Linux Mint and installing it on another, installing another version of Linux Mint on a secondary hard drive plugged in by USB. I forgot to remove the laptop drive or disconnect the laptop drive, and I had to go back and repair grub on my main hard drive.
Well, I won't even tell you how many times I've done that. One of the first things that I always suggest is when you get a new Windows computer is to go ahead and make up those backup disks.
Yeah, if they give you that option.
Yeah, I think they usually prompt you, but if they don't, you can go use Google and it'll tell you how to do it manually. I always thought it was the stupidest thing having to make your own backup disks, and they put everything on that little restore partition. And my thing is, what happens when your hard drive goes bad? You're kind of out of luck.
Yeah. Yeah, you are.
Why do they do that? Is it just call savings? Is it that much money to include a disk?
Well, it is because, not because it costs them that much money, but because Microsoft gives them a tremendous break on the cost of the operating system, provided that they don't provide the user with a copy of Windows that they could use, they could, you know, potentially pirate or sell or whatever.
Okay.
So they get a break on their licensing for the Windows operating system by not providing installation media.
Now, just a clarification, just so for my own clarification, Windows, you don't really own a software, you're just licensing it, right? They still own it.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
And they license you for using it on a single computer, and depending on which version of Windows, you may be able to install it on a backup copy on a second computer.
Okay. But Linux, you actually own the software, so you can do what you want with it, basically.
Right. So the GPL, which is the license under which Linux is provided to you, provides you with the rights to be able to install it on anywhere you want. You can give it away. You can sell it to someone else. You can modify the source code. You can redistribute your modifications to the source code and sell that if you wish, or just give it away. And if you do make some modifications to Linux itself or any of the underlying tools, the GPL requires that you provide your source code back to the upstream. So if you make a modification to Linux kernel, for example, you're required to give your modifications back to the Linux kernel. Now, they don't have to use it, but you're required to give it back. So anyway, it's so that as people make improvements to this open source software, that everyone benefits from the improvements that people make. And if your modifications don't end up being improvements, but are just tweaks for you, they're not going to include it in the source code unless it's really good, which case everyone then has access to the good work that you did. That's just the way open source works.
Sounds like a plan to me.
Yep.
Okay, our next email come from Gus. He writes, "Dear Larry and Bill, hey Gus.
Hey Gus.
After listening to your last episode on customization, I wanted to give you guys a tip pertaining to docs. I have always found Docky to be better than Cairo in that it feels faster and less bulky. Docky only annoyed me in that it has the big anchor icon. Then I found an article on OMG Ubuntu that tells you how, using a command, you can remove the anchor and access settings by right-clicking somewhere on the dock. This tweak makes it much more Mac-like. Make sure gconf-2 is installed for this to work, and the command that he gives us is in the show notes if you're interested." And then he writes, "Another thing is a configuration tool for Conky called Conky Colors. It is available on GNOME Look, and with Conky installed, you simply make and make install Conky colors from the tarball, which you can then use to configure Conky using some added arguments to the Conky colors command that the tarball adds. It is extremely easy to use, and if you pipe the help option into a text file, you have an easy guide to getting Conky set up nicely with everything from system monitoring to weather to Gmail notifier and update notifier on Ubuntu and Debian based systems. It allows you to tweak Conky without getting deep into LUA and has a nice theme control. And the Conky color link is in the show notes.
All right. Well, thanks, Gus. That sounds like some great tips. We'll take a look at them. And I know in the Conky configuration, you can set up colors. So maybe there's more to this Conky colors than just colors. It sounds like maybe it is from Gus's description. What do you think?
The last time I looked at Conky, it's basically a big text file, and you have to, and if you read it, you can, I guess this is an easier way that to actually change the colors, because you'd actually have to go in with a text editor and change the settings in it. It's not hard. It's just if you've never seen a Conky text file, especially a real big one, it can be really, really complicated and takes a while. It looks like source code almost.
Yeah, it does. It does. It's
so anything that makes it easier would be great.
Yeah, but there's plenty of tutorials on it. But yeah, anyway, we'll give it a try and see if this provides some advantages. Why don't you read the next one, Bill? I've pre-recorded Jaloo's email because it's very long, and we'll play that one next as our last email. So take Andrew's email as well, if you will, Bill.
Okay. Well, Andrew wrote us because he had some Wi-Fi issues with an older computer. He writes, I started using Linux in 2006, and now I have a server that runs Linux, and I also run it on my laptops. I went back to Windows 7 on my laptops when Linux would not support my Wi-Fi cards, and that was about 2 years ago. I still have not found a distro that will support it, and I have a Dell Latitude D520 and a Dell Inspiron 1520. I want to go back to Linux on them, but I need to have the Wi-Fi to work. I love Linux and don't like Windows, but still need it for WoW and iTunes. I want Linux back on my laptops as soon as possible. Can you help? Thanks. And I have been going through all the podcasts right now, and I am on number 42 and looking forward to the rest of them. And you guys are doing a great job. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, I provided Andrew some suggestions. The computers he's using are not that old, but old enough that the Wi-Fi cards in them may not be supported by the Linux kernel at all. And I've suggested that he try an either a PC MCIA, a PC card, wireless card, Wi-Fi mm-hmm. card, or a USB Wi-Fi card, and try one of those. And just about any of the inexpensive ones would be supported by Linux. But, you know, you can go to just do a Google search on the model that you're about to purchase. Do this before you buy it. The model you're about to purchase, and in combination with the words Linux compatibility, and mm-hmm. see, you know, you'll find a compatibility website that will look that will give you some idea as to whether or not that particular Wi-Fi card is supported. And we'll have a link in the show notes to our links on the various sites that provide hardware compatibility lists.
Yeah. Well, couldn't you use NDIS? I can't remember, wrapper. It's
NDIS wrapper?
Yeah,
sure.
NDIS that, size wrapper.
That's another way to go. You could try, if you have the Windows driver or can download the Windows driver for your wireless card, you can use that. And just, let's see, are we... Did he say which version or which distribution he's... No, he didn't. So
no, he didn't.
Yeah, go to the forums for the distribution that you have and look up NDIS wrapper, and they will have some instructions there on how to, for your particular distribution, how to enable that, what you need to install to make that work. And give that a try. That might be the least expensive solution, although that's something that will cause you to learn a little more about Linux, let's put
but
it that way.
I would also suggest, if I was going to point him in, because he didn't really give a preference to the distro he wanted to use, I would go ahead and push him more or suggest a Linux Mint for this one, because I know Linux Mint includes a lot more Wi-Fi drivers and a little other doodads that make things run just a little bit easier than stock Ubuntu. So what I'd make is I would make a live DVD or CD and see if Linux Mint wouldn't work out of the box, because I've actually had a computer that Ubuntu would not work out of the box. I could get the driver to work, but I'd still have to connect it using you know, an Ethernet cable until I could get the driver to, for that card. But when I used Linux Mint, it automatically found it and worked. So just an idea.
Yeah, very good point. Good point. Okay. All right, our next email is from Jalu, who wrote this first of a promised two emails. This one might spur some discussion. Jalu, expect a response from Nancy on this one. Jalu writes, "Hello, Larry and newly upgraded co-host, WB4BBC, KD6RZH waving. I do not fully expect you to respond to or address this email, but I do feel that the time has come to say, enough is enough. Originally, I intended this as one writing, detailing two separate issues that lay close to my heart, but soon realized that it would be too long, so I have decided to split it into two separate mailings. The second will follow later, should you decide to address the first. To begin, I do not know if you have recorded your reply to the episode that I'm going to reference, or if you're working on it, but I could not stand the suspense any longer and had to pass on my two cents for what it's worth. I consider myself a Linux purist. This is only to reference myself as a person that uses Linux 100%. And so I get very annoyed hearing from people that claim to be Linux users, but just can't resist telling the rest of us how they too would be full converts if it were not for that one piece of Windows software that they just cannot live without. If it's not games, it's Photoshop or their favorite presentation software that just has no match in the Unix world. Okay, I get it. Your life is dependent on Microsoft products and you will never leave. That's fine, and I wish all of them happy computing. Just go about your life and leave the rest of us that are free from the burdens, restrictions, and lockdowns of Microsoft alone. Like you, we are very happy using FOSS, free open source software. I understand that there are reasons to keep using Windows. Many job and business applications are still very reliant on Windows platforms, and I have no problem with that. But this is not true for everyone. In fact, it seems to me that outside the US, more people and businesses are in fact switching to open standards. On Going Linux episode 201, you read a letter of challenge from longtime listener and Linux user Nancy. Nancy begins her letter with a background review proudly proclaiming her extensive use of her Windows PC. Almost instantly, she begins in chastisement, extolling the wonders and benefits of the Microsoft product with statements like, her Windows machines, not cuss words, are tools, not toys, and she has never experienced a virus problem, ever. I'm not calling Nancy a liar, but to write to not only this show, but to any Linux-based podcast and state so jubilantly and with such conviction the qualities of an OS known worldwide to be released with more holes than Swiss cheese, made me suspect of her motives. She continued ranting that she also uses Mac as well, but just to keep her hands in the, quote, Mac game, so she can service them, adding the list of software titles she uses. Then she begins demeaning Linux and to some degree Mac by telling you that she is a 10-year Quicken user, and although there are other alternatives, they are not Quicken and she intends to keep using it. Quicken is good software, but really, nothing can replace it. It seems to me that she is only dependent on it because of long-time use. And as she points out, banks use it. And none of her banks have a download option for Linux. If asked, I'm sure Chris Fisher of LAS, Linux Action Show, an IT pro and Linux advocate that has working knowledge of the banking industry, would probably have some interesting commentary on that statement. Astonished, I looked into this to satisfy my own curiosity, and here is what I found. There is indeed an open-source financial software title that competes with Quicken, and its name is KMyMoney. So as not to have you reliant on my word, I have included a few statements from satisfied customers on the KMM website, who also reference Quicken. Steffi states, I have said this before, but I am happy to say it again. As a long-term, but now ex-Quicken user, and a GNU Cash user, also now ex, for a year, I think that KMM is just fabulous. To anyone who designed, built, and actively maintains and enhances it, thank you for doing your marvelous work for the world. Graham Nichols wrote, KMyMoney is a very polished application. It works just fine, and I have no niggles at all. Much better than Quicken Personal Plus 2009 on Vista or XP. Bob Igo says, I switched from Quicken to KMyMoney 2, having first tried GNU Cash. I really needed to escape the forced upgrading built into Quicken for simple things like stock price lookups. And finally, Algis Kabaly wrote, I confess, too, that one of my favorite hates is accounting, and I only do it when I am forced to, mostly by my spouse of, wait for it, 57 years uninterrupted marriage. I must say, though, that KMyMoney makes this generally unpleasant task so much easier, and to think that I put up with Quicken in my Windows days. Jalou continues, perhaps the learning curve is just a little too advanced in KMM for Nancy to grasp. Nancy continues to enforce her statements with her justification of Microsoft software titles that are not ported to Linux. Imagine that. In addition, she reports that she owns an Epson printer. The Mac has no driver, while Linux just finds the printer and uses it. Who would have guessed? She also mentions that she needed a file and print server to allow connection to all of her PCs, yet she conveniently never states which version of Windows Server she will be buying. A short feel-good moment comes to Linux users as she says she could give up the Mac because there is nothing she cannot do on it that she cannot do in Linux or Windows, but she got a good deal on it, meaning it was cheap, and like Mikey, she likes it. I never saw that coming. Okay, now that we're all feeling better on the direction she's heading, she rebounds with another Linux attack. Again, she wants justification, but this time to use Linux for more than just being a geek, considering its cost, noting that virus-free in her estimation is not a selling point. Really? She needs to find something that Linux does that neither of the other platforms do, huh? She continues by listing some impressive software titles that she runs on all three platforms. Then again, rips into Linux, stating that Linux needs so much hand-holding, and she cannot afford to waste her precious time just to make it work unless there's only one way. After all, her Mac and Windows machines just work. At this point, I'm convinced that her knowledge of Linux is very limited, As anyone who has used Linux for even a short period of time realizes its benefits. Her failure to understand this, as well as her inability to understand how to make it run without the need to make adjustments and tinkering with it on a constant basis, is true indication, at least to me, that she is not doing it right and should return to the beginner's class. She apparently feels the need to make us poor Linux users feel good again, as she mentions the various flavors of Linux she uses because that is the, quote, geek in her. Wow. I suppose that she does not realize that, quote, real geeks do not experience the problems and pitfalls she encounters on a daily basis, which is why they are geeks. Finally, after her tirade, she has the audacity, not the software, because she did mention that she does use it, and the gall to end by challenging you to give her a reason to stay on Linux. I cannot say with any certainty why you accepted this challenge, but I do question why. What is the point? This woman is a devoted Microsoft user, and you would not change her mind regardless of what you say. Besides this, why would you want to? Windows is a good operating system for people with a limited skill set. That is not to ridicule Windows users, but there is truth in the statement that Windows dumbs you down. Listening as you read this letter reminded me my theory is true. There are a core group of Windows users, like Nancy, who consider themselves to be Windows power users. These people refuse to understand that when they see the average Linux user performing what seems to be extremely difficult tasks with ease on their Linux boxes, they too can just pick up a Linux box and do the same. When it does not work as expected, and they cannot figure out why, instantly it is the fault of Linux because they use an operating system far superior to ours. As a Linux user, I have it installed on two laptops, Linux Mint and Chakra, dual boot on one, and Vector Linux on the second. Four desktops, Linux Mint and Ubuntu dual boot, while Xorin and Slackware occupy the others. One server running Ubuntu, a free NAS server, a BSD variant, and an unraid server. I never have cause or reason to handhold any of these systems as all of them, quote, just work with the efficiency of an ever-ready battery. I am not stating that Linux is a superior operating system over Windows or Mac, but I do feel that it is a more advanced operating system, and these Windows users should realize that Linux users like me adhere to that old North American commercial that states we would rather fight than switch.
Well, 73 to you, Jalou, and thanks for that great email. It's always good to have another ham operator write into us. You make some good points, and I'm sure we're going to get plenty of feedback on this. So what's your take on this, Larry?
Oh, yeah, we're going to get plenty of feedback, and if we don't hear from Nancy, I'd be surprised as well. So feel free to comment, especially if you have arguments to support Jalou's position, and even more if you have arguments on the other side.
Yeah.
As I've said in the past, I am not a Linux zealot to the point. I'm not, Jalou, I'm not calling you a Linux zealot. You make some very good points about, you know, Windows users, if they want to use Windows, should be allowed to use Windows. I mean, it's all about choice, right? And my choice is to use all of the operating systems that I know how to use. And I'm kind of with Nightwise on this, where, you know, you should make technology work for you, not the other way around. And if Windows or Mac can do something better, then you should be using Windows or Mac. And Linux doesn't do everything perfectly. Even though we would like to think that it could do everything perfectly, it doesn't at this point. So, your point that you make, Jalou, that if a Windows user is convinced that Linux will not do something that they want it to do, there's nothing that we can say to justify them switching to Linux. Their mind is made up, and that's just the way it is. So we get that point. Let's hear what our listeners have to say on this one, shall we?
Yeah, Yeah, I'm staying out of that one, but he did make some good points. And
yep.
And just remember, I didn't say anything. Don't flame me.
Yeah, yeah, you did stay out of this one very well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I learned quick.
We've had quite a long episode here, and over an hour. I think even with editing, this one will be over an hour. So I think it's time to wrap up, Bill.
All right.
Okay, our next episode is Computer America number 64. And until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at Going Linux, the website for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done. If you want to support our efforts, please click the donate button while you're there on our website.
You can download episodes directly from our website, or you can play them right from our show notes page. Or better still, go to subscribe.goinglinux.com. to learn about subscribing to the podcast so you don't miss an episode.
And you can send us your feedback. We'll play your audio files or voicemail messages on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com. Our voicemail line is 1-904-468-7889.
And remember to leave your topic suggestion on our forums at forum.goinglinux.com or participate in our Google Plus community. Look for Going Linux Podcast.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
73.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.